Welcome to another episode of Bulletproof. Once again, we like to tell all our guests stay bulletproof. We have another amazing guest, but before we even bring her on, I'd like to thank our listeners for making us a top seven Apple podcast right now and putting us back into the top five of Spotify. And it's not because of my voice, as much as I think it's okay and cool and hot. It's because of my amazing guests. And I have a new amazing guest that I've been so excited to speak to. She's a retired CIA, yeah, that's easy for me to say, a retired CIA counterterrorism. She's a retired CIA counterterrorism. Can you believe this? Counterterrorism specialist, an author, and so much more. And Gina, thank you. Thank God for me that I do editing, because there we go. Gina, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm so excited to speak with you today. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
There's so much I want to get into. So many interesting things, and so many things you've been into.
Ask
Yeah,
away.
no, it's going
Ask
to be
away.
fun. Counterterrorism, which is easy for me to say, is that something that you were always kind of into, or did you kind of fall into that, or how does that even come into one's, foresight?
Yeah, this was ne definitely not something that I saw myself doing as a kid or even in college. It was really accidental. My first job in intelligence, I think I was 21, only a few months out of college, and it just happened to be in one of these 24/7 watch offices, intel watch offices that you see on TV, although they're nothing as cool as that, but where you're just monitoring intelligence activity and traffic during the 24-hour cycle. And my role, because it was an available opening and I competed and got the job, was as what they called a terrorism watch officer. So I was literally a GS5, which is pretty low on the totem pole. And my role every 8 hours was to monitor whatever intelligence information came in about an incident of terrorism, or, we had hostages at the time in Bekaa Valley and in Lebanon. This was the 80s. And so at one point, Panem 103 was attacked. I mean, some people might remember that. It was quite a while ago. I think it was 1989.
It was 1989. Yes.
Okay, or I
I
couldn't remember,
remember
but
because I
at
was a
any rate,
senior in high school, believe it or not. But I remember
okay.
that whole thing.
So I was just a few years older than some of the kids that were on that flight, and I had the opportunity to do some intel support to the investigation, and it just, I think, just seeing the victims' families, moms and dads and siblings, and they were all, they were all waiting for their relatives to come home for Christmas. And it just, I don't know, it just gets inside your skin. It gets inside the core of who you are. And I just realized, oh, this is what I want to do. I want to prevent this from happening again. And I just got that early on, and that stuck.
That's amazing. Well, again, I happen to know the answer, but for people that are listening out there that are not police officers or military or what have you, what is the biggest, when you had an ability to get into the CIA? Because people like the CIA is like this, like Oz, right? It's like this weird. Explain to people that are listening the difference, the biggest difference between the FBI and the CIA. And what the difference is between both.
Well, the two big differences are, number one, the CIA is not law enforcement. It does not have the authority to arrest anyone. It also doesn't have any authorities to do investigative work in the United States on American citizens. So it is overseas focused.
Overseas, right?
Those are the two major differences. And those are pretty big.
No,
So we talk
absolutely.
about the wall between the United States and the rest of the
The
world.
rest of the world.
Our job is to protect America from the rest of the world. So FBI's
Now,
job is to protect America from the inside.
and go after our
And
presidents.
of course, yes.
And weaponize the no, it's a whole nother story. So you had some pretty interesting, because when you were doing it in the 80s, right? You mentioned that you started in what year?
In 1988, under
1988. So that was
Ronald
a
Reagan.
wild time. Right. That was a lot of crazy things going on back then. But I had read something interesting. In 1993, you had mentioned, about the early Bin Laden warnings, right? Again, at 93, the Twin Towers were, that's the first time they got hit on a much smaller level. What was the biggest signs that you had seen personally as an expert? And what was your thoughts after 1993 when that first happened?
No, so back to where I started when I was on that 24/7 watch. The late 1980s were a crazy time for sure. And in 1989, or by the beginning of 1989, the Soviet troops that had been inside Afghanistan fighting the Afghans were pulling out. They were withdrawing. So there had been this 10-year war. The Soviet Union was trying to expand yet again and conquered Afghanistan for the most part, installed a communist regime, and the United States and some other countries were supporting the resistance, the Afghan resistance, to push them back into the Soviet Union, get rid of that. So much like we tried in Vietnam and North Korea, and so at any rate, in 1989, what happened with the Soviet troops is they gave up. And of course, shortly thereafter, the Soviet Union fell. It ceased to exist, and we won the Cold War, and it was very the peace dividend of the 1990s. But what I started noticing was, and what people weren't really paying attention to back then, is that it wasn't just the Afghans fighting the Soviets. There were tens of thousands of men who had come from all other countries around the world, over 50 countries around the world, who volunteered to help support the Afghan Mujahideen, the Afghan fighters. And that was fine with all of us because they were kicking out the Soviet, they were kicking Soviet troops. But as the Soviets began pulling out and the war was essentially won, a lot of them were leaving because it was no longer the right kind of fight for their religious purposes. And so they were leaving. And I started noticing this outflow of individuals who were foreign fighters in Afghanistan. They were a veteran of that war and they were showing up in other places, North Africa, all the way over to East Asia, in the Philippines. And they were joining extremists or even terrorists or criminal groups in their home countries. But one of the things that was started to become pretty clear even before the 93 timeframe is that they were engaged in some violent activity, not all of them, but enough of them in enough different places that it became a trend and it became very odd. And they were still wearing their Afghan hats, or they were in some way letting people know that they had these street credentials of having fought in the Afghan war. And that brought them a lot of credibility in extremist movements in individual countries because, of course, again, to kick the Soviet Union out, I mean, that was a superpower. That was a pretty, it really generated a lot of mythology around individuals who could say and claim that they fought in Afghanistan. So it was, just something that was transnational and unusual and wasn't being sponsored by a specific state. And that's really what got me thinking there's something here,
Well, you also with Algeria when that got in 1991. I mean, that was pre, obviously, Twin Towers. What were your thoughts on that, and where were you? And what were your thoughts in 91 when that all happened? Did you see it as like kind of almost like a buildup where this thing is starting to gain traction, and that was just the beginning as it's starting to grow, or?
That was one of the areas, but there are a lot of smaller signs that, again, I think you really had to be looking for them. Kashmir, again, the Philippines and the Abu Sayyaf group becoming, starting to have more people who had fought in Afghanistan. Algeria is a one place. Sudan and of course East Africa have always been,
My
an
bad.
area. but also across Egypt and North Africa, just entirely across North Africa, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco. But in Egypt, there was this real intensification of what it was called the Islamic group, the Gamaat al-Islamiyah, and they became much more violent and aggressive against police as well as Coptic Christians in that country. So it was it really felt like it was infusing grassroots movements to become more ambitious, more violent.
Well, also, I mean, in that time frame, well, I'm jumping all over the place. Then you have Kuwait, right? So you have that whole thing. That's a storm going on at that point in time too, which is another point in time that is in the time frame from when you started till, all the way to today. What with Desert once Desert Storm started, was that something? And again, it's just an opinion I'm asking you. I'm not, but is that something you think we should have got involved with?
Oh, well, I was a big fan of how George H.W. Bush framed that. We were there to protect the integrity of a border that had been internationally recognized. And I think, from my perspective, total opinion.
No, right.
Yeah,
That's right.
completely
No,
opinion.
right. Go.
The international system is nothing if it doesn't respect borders. So whether or not we should have or shouldn't have, I wouldn't decide that based on the unintended consequences. The unintended consequence really is of our decision to partner with the Saudis and put troops inside Saudi Arabia at their request to protect Saudi Arabia. That is what irritated, and irritated is a nice word, Osama bin Laden and his followers, especially the Saudis among his followers who believed that it was unholy and for non-Muslim troops to be protecting the two holy places, the Saudi kingdom. And he had asked the king, if he and his glorious, victorious Al-Qaeda members, jihadists from Afghanistan could come and protect the Holy Land. And of course he was rebuffed in favor of the American military power and structure. But that, I mean, it's not so much our involvement with Iraq and pushing, because I mean, bin Laden had no love for Saddam, but it was more that we planted ourselves in a country that had a division in terms of its approval or disapproval of American troops there. And Al Qaeda and bin Laden and his feeling, I think, it represented the majority of Saudi opinion at that time.
Well, see,
You know, if you're a kingdom, you don't necessarily want a military that is going to be able to overthrow you if you're a monarch.
sure.
So you have a Saudi Arabia that was vulnerable to the possibility that Saddam would invade, so they needed help.
No, I agree. And the reason why I'm asking is I agree with, I'm of like mind with that, and that's why I figured, you would have the same type of opinion, but that's why we do these, right? Keep it interesting. And so moving forward, there's so many different things. I'm just trying to go through chronologically timelines, and get your opinions on some major events. So let's move to 1993 with the bombing, the truck bomb in the Twin Towers. What was the biggest surprise at that point in time? That was actually pulled off, and why do you think that we kind of put our guard down a couple years later, knowing that they had the ability to do something like this? What, from your opinion, was the biggest surprise, and what was the biggest awakening when that was actually pulled off?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I'm surprised, I'm surprised it wasn't more deadly. Wasn't truly all that surprised that it happened.
Why is that?
I had been working before the 1993 World Trade Center attack with some folks from the FBI and State Department who were, working on what to do about the sort of subgroup active in that area in Brooklyn and New York, around the Blind Sheikh, and what turned out to be, it was called the Al-Kifa Refugee Center, but it was an organization, a non-governmental organization that Bin Laden had taken over around the world, and it was facilitating individuals who were adhered to what he was trying to do. And so we were working on trying to identify illegal activity in order to, because we did
Right.
not, I mean, people won't understand it now, but we did not have legal authorities to do a lot of prevention. The FBI didn't have that. And so we were supporting it, the CIA, from the perspective of, the Egyptians. We're putting pressure on, this is what this guy is doing. And we knew that the network was related to Al-Qaeda hubs elsewhere in the world. We didn't know it as Al-Qaeda at the time, but we knew they were related to Bin Laden. So I guess that, to me, where there's a lot of smoke, there's going to eventually be fire. So I wasn't really truly too surprised by the attack itself. Bin Laden had been accused of backing the 1992 hotel bombings or attempted hotel bombings in Yemen
Right,
by the
that's right.
Yemeni Islamic Jihad. Very similar, this is very similar activity to what I was saying was happening across North Africa and East Asia,
Right.
where those two hotels were, they were attacked because they were housing U.S. Marines. And the attacks didn't work. The one of the bombers killed himself, but the other one survived. And so the Yemeni investigation led to identifying Bin Laden as one of the sponsors of that. Of course, he denied it, but it didn't, whatever. But so it was clear they were active, that they had gone active. This wasn't just an
Random.
idea or an ambition anymore. It was action. And so that time frame, it didn't surprise me that we had that attack. But like I said, I was surprised that it wasn't more lethal. I think the reason we let our guard down, though, afterwards, couple of things. I mean, one might consider that the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing with, Timothy McVeigh and Jerry Nichols sort of changed how people thought about terrorism in the United States isn't always just from Islamic extremists. Maybe. I don't know. But I think the main reason is because, again, at the time, without the sort of authorities and pipelines that the CIA and the FBI needed in order to cooperate, and of course, there is no homeland security at this point. The Bureau, understandably, is investigating based on crimes that have happened, and they're trying to bring that to prosecution. So they're investigating the 1993 attack with that in mind. Who were the people who were involved, and how do we bring them to justice? The problem is what I mean, a handful of us were seeing is that the people involved in that direct attack were just probably just deployed there to do it. In the classic Al-Qaeda world, and any terrorism, organization really, your leadership doesn't go and conduct the attacks. Your leadership directs a cell of operatives to go and conduct the attacks. So while the Bureau was chasing down who they thought was the mastermind, Ramzi Yosef, we believe the masterminds were really sitting back in Sudan, where Bin Laden was at the time, and then eventually Afghanistan, where he moved. And so I think that when we captured Ramzi Yosef in 1995 and he stood trial and, he was jailed and the whole network was imprisoned and, had been to jail and all that, that there was this feeling of, okay, we destroyed that. But we didn't, we just So I
Gotcha.
think that's really what happened, but.
Got it. So, again, not to rehash the whole 9/11 thing as well, because I was actually there. Believe it, I was there the first night as a police officer, and it was mayhem. I mean, because we were still there when it was a rescue at the point. We were in
Find
the pit
people,
there trying to, sift through, find people. And again, we didn't have helmets, we didn't have masks, we had nothing because we weren't prepared for that, right? So luckily I was only there the first night. It was one of the craziest things I've ever seen. So we won't go into that whole thing again because we've talked about that at noise, a lot of people have. And it's not even worth rehashing. But my question to you, and this is the big one, is do you believe in today's day and age, and I have my opinions, that something as big as 9/11 could happen again on US soil?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Do you think that we kind of just take things for granted and it's going to be? Because I'll tell you one other quick funny story. We were
Yeah.
working on a separate note on a film, right? Basically about terrorism. And are you familiar with Times Square where they have like those big bleachers?
Yeah.
So in the film, the scene was, make a long story short, it was a Christmas time. It was a walk and talk scene where we're following a terrorist who leaves a package in the middle of Times Square on the bleacher, and we all walk away. So there was a package left in Times Square as we all left, and whatever reason, a prop guy didn't run and go get it quickly, and everybody was walking over it. Nobody, everybody was just so lax, and it became a big story by accident. So it's just amazing how people forget and they get so lax after a while. Everybody's a 10, and then it goes down. Is there certain signs to look out for, or do you think we have the intelligence to know that something might be coming, or is it just like, we just got to get lucky?
This is a hard question to answer just because the times right now are a little different.
Right.
You have so many people who are seasoned in terrorism and counterterrorism world in the security space, whether in the intelligence or, in the operational side of our national security community and apparatus who have left or have been forced out. The sort of slashing of all of that does leave, I think, does leave us vulnerable to that lack of knowledge and integration. That being said, apart from that, we will never be capable of 100% certainty, right? You couldn't possibly fund an intelligence community enough. Even there are murders in prison, right? So even if we
Right.
created this country and made it a prison in terms of safety and security, we would still have attacks. I think it's not so much what to look out for to prevent it. I mean, obviously bystanders are still the number one. Bystanders and defectors from a terrorist organization or any other criminal organization are still the best resource for preventing something. I mean,
Right.
you know that. Luck being a good part of that as well. But the most important thing really is because we can't be vigilant all the time. No one wants to live their life that way. Like,
No,
you don't
I
want to
agree.
live your life that way. But what you can do is, in communities, in towns, in cities, in states, is think about, okay, if something happens, what's our response going to be? Are we going to respond with fear and, start like not talking to anybody and creating our bunkers? Or are we going to respond with the ultimate F you and, just go about your day the way you would before? I mean, I always thought George W. Bush had it right when after 9/11, before Black Friday hit, he said, when people were asking, well, what do we do about security? Everyone was afraid. And he said, go shopping. And, a lot of people criticized him for being dismissive of people's fears, but he was right. He was, I mean, in my opinion, if he really wanted to defeat the terrorists, the only way to do that is to tell them, you're not affecting us. You have no
Right, live
impact
your
on
life.
us.
Right.
We are who we are. We're not going to become a caliphate because you keep attacking us. That's just not going to happen. So I don't
Agreed.
know. I think
Agreed.
it's, I don't want to see people living their life afraid,
Right. Agreed. Agreed. And I just, because we're coming again, I had told you this is coming on, and I could talk to you forever. We're running short on time. So, Gina, also you have a couple books that you've written. If you could quickly touch on the books and how people can find
Yeah,
them and
sure.
how people can reach out to you, that would be amazing.
Sure. Yeah, no, thank you. So I have three books. Two of them are nonfiction and they're National Security Mom. That's the title,
That's a
one and
great
two.
title. Love
And
it.
thank you. It's really to try to make counterterrorism, just the mission of national security, more accessible and less jargony. It really relates what you do at the national level and even international level to what you do as a parent. What you do in your family, because you keep people safe, you try, but you also keep them secure in the sense of, if your house is burnt down, you don't cease to be a family. I mean, you're still a family because you still love each other, you still care about each other, you're still connected. So your safety and your security as a family and our security as a nation are also different, and they're dependent on different things. We are secure as Americans as long as we continue to be Americans, follow the Constitution, all the good parts of our democracy. So it really tries to relate those two, like being a parent
That's awesome.
and being a national security
And
person.
how do they find that, Gina? If I was
Oh, that's you
people
can
that are
find it
listening.
on. It's on, you can find it on Amazon. It's just National Security Mom. There's National Security Mom 1, which is probably the foundational one, and then National Security Mom 2, but just Gina Bennett. And then,
And how does all listeners find you?
oh yeah, so I have a new Goodreads profile that just got stood up by my publisher because I just published a third book, but
Oh, wow.
it's a fiction, it's a historical fiction. It's called If Two of Them Are Dead. I actually have one right here. Yeah.
Wait,
If
there you go.
two
Put it back a little bit. Put it
of
back a little bit.
if two
A
of
little back.
them oh,
Oh,
yeah,
there you
sorry.
go. There you go. Okay, cool.
Yeah, well, if two of them are dead. Anyway, this is a book that's really imagines what happens if we lost the Revolutionary War. And I wrote it because I wanted to bring to life a real life but unknown, or anonymous, I should say, spy from the Revolutionary War, and pair her with a friend of mine who was killed by Al Qaeda in Afghanistan, kind of like bring her back to life through my main character. And it's just my way of still being with her,
Amazing.
So it's a spy thriller and a mystery all at the same time. It's just a fun book.
And
And
that's out right now, Gina.
yes, it's also
Perfect.
on Amazon. If two of them are dead, and it comes from a Benjamin Franklin quote. So Ben Franklin once said that three can keep a secret if two of them are dead. So,
That's
like,
amazing.
he didn't know a good spy.
Yeah, it's funny. That's great. So, like I said, Gina, thank you so much. Again, I could talk to you for 2 hours. And again, when the book comes out, it's out. But I'm saying, if you want to get you back, we could definitely get back, you back on, and we'll talk about the book solely and get into the book, and that would be amazing.
Oh,
But
yeah. It's kind of
I'd
fun
like
to
to thank
imagine
you.
us in the British States of America, and say,
We don't have
well,
yellow teeth right now. We
what
don't
would
have
it be
bad
like?
teeth. Man. That's funny. Well, Gina, thank you so much today. I'd
You.
like to thank, first of all, our sponsors at Believe. I'd like to thank our listeners who are climbing us up the charts. And I'd like to thank amazing guests like Gina Bennett today, who actually, again, I can listen to all the time for hours. And I'm going to again. So, Gina, thank you so much. To
Thank
my
you.
listeners, stay bulletproof, and we'll see you next week. I guess there we are. Jane, that was awesome. Like I said,
Yeah.
there's so much I want to talk. Again, I don't want to get too much into the weeds. I'd love
Yeah.
to, but I didn't know where you were going, comfortable going, because I was got
Yeah.
into the CIA today, and what your thoughts are as far as when you got involved back
Yeah.
in the day. As far as the difference between being when I was a cop in the 90s to being a cop today,
Yeah.
different worlds.
Yeah.
But well, again, I'd love to have you again to get into
Sure.
that part of
Yeah.
it.
Yeah.
The way this cuts, it cuts very abruptly. So I just wanted to get everything before we finished.
Sure. Yeah,
So,
no. Yeah, please feel free. Muneeb was wonderful in staying in touch with me and getting us set up, and I'm happy to do it again if you want to touch on anything. I have had so much cleared from the agency because, the 9/11 commission sort of outed me. The paper that you're referring to from 1993 that was declassified, it had my name on it. And that was, once that happened, that was that. And so the CIA's public affairs office used me quite a lot to talk to media and documentaries and all that kind of stuff. So there is a lot I can talk about with regard to the,
Yeah, no,
yeah.
that's what I'm saying. Like a
Yeah.
half hour doesn't do you justice. That's why, like I said, I'd love to speak to you again in the future. And I thank you so much for being patient with me.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No,
Sorry
and
about
I,
that.
no,
Sorry
please
about
do
that.
not apologize. And I, please let me know. I hope that it's solvable, resolvable.
Yes, me too.
Yeah.
Me too. That's like me trying to say anti-terrorism.
Oh, yeah. No, I
So.
know. It's so funny. I remember once working on the National Terrorism Commission, with Jerry Bremer, Paul Bremer, who was a CPA later, the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq many years later. But it was called the National Terrorism Commission, and it was a congressionally stood up CT thing in 1999. And I used to answer the phone, National Terrorism Commission, National. And somebody said, "What are you doing a commission on tourism for?"
Oh my God, that's so funny. So funny.
I guess I
Crazy.
said terrorism too fast, right?
That's so funny. But like I said, thank you so much. I'm gonna let you know when
Sure.
it's up.
Okay.
We'll send you over, and again, we'll share the amount of downloads. We usually get, from 25,000 to 50, depending
That's
on a
awesome.
weekly
Well, I
basis.
hope I don't hurt your chart rising.
No, I know you'll absolutely help it, and I hopefully
Okay.
we can transfer that to some book sales.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
So, thank you so
All
much.
righty. Take
Take
care.
care. Thank you.
Well, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.